Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another edition of the Bills on the Border podcast. It's our 19th episode, so we're closing on episode 20, coming close to hitting on a milestone. It is Monday, July 12th. I'm joined in studio with Mr. Thomas Watson. Tommy, how are you?
Doing pretty good. Overcame a bout of shingles, which only perpetuated my high school nickname of old man because that is traditionally an old person's disease.
We've given you trouble over the years for your early bedtimes, your 4 o'clock dinners, your general elderly demeanor, and now it's kind of all, I mean, I think the shingles diagnosis is just the nail in the coffin. You're Benjamin Button. I mean, you are an old man.
I know,
in a young person's body. So hopefully that wasn't too excruciatingly painful. It doesn't look great still, but I think it looks better.
It'll get better.
Yeah. Anyways, we got a lot of stuff to talk about this week in the world of sports. Want to go ahead and jump right into the biggest story, I think, from last week, which was NBA free agency. There have been a lot of movement of different players. Of course, LaMarcus Aldridge going to the San Antonio Spurs. The other big name on the market was DeAndre Jordan. As we all know from kind of the storylines from last week, on July 3rd, he had initially verbally committed to the Dallas Mavericks. He had meetings with Mark Cuban, with Chandler Parsons of the Dallas Mavericks. And it all was, everything but the contract pointed towards DeAndre Jordan signing with the Dallas Mavericks and no longer playing for the Los Angeles Clippers. And, you know, of course, the important part there was the signing of that contract. So last week on Wednesday in the morning, we start hearing some rumors of DeAndre Jordan had gotten cold feet and he was considering backing out of that deal. And of course, Thursday was the date that teams could start, or at least midnight on Thursday was the time that teams could finally start signing those free agents to the deals that they had verbally agreed upon. And it was just kind of this, it was like a sideshow almost. I mean, but I hate to say sideshow because it was like a marquee event. I mean, Twitter was going crazy, ESPN was going crazy. People were trying to verify sources. We were hearing things that Mark Cuban was driving around downtown Houston, calling members of DeAndre Jordan's family, trying to get a hold of him in the 11th hour before he signed, inked a deal with the Los Angeles Clippers and jumped ship. I mean, it was just crazy. And as a casual NBA fan, what was it like for you kind of on the sidelines witnessing everything that took place?
I thought it was kind of amazing to see someone just pull a total, you know, 180 like that. You know, I feel like you don't see that in a lot of sports. You have someone who's ready, just needs to sign the contract with one team, and then within a week, they're back with the club, like, right, sign deal and everything.
And that's the challenge of this NBA moratorium period, because essentially what happens is teams can start talking to free agents during this moratorium period, but no official agreements can be reached. They can't sign a deal.
Yeah.
And the moratorium is essentially in place so the NBA execs can focus on at least people that work for the NBA front office can focus on establishing that salary cap for the following season, which was set at $70 million. So really, you can do whatever you want up into that period to try and get your players to either, you know, consider making a deal. While it's probably not a good business practice, it's probably frowned upon by most of these teams of what the Clippers did. It certainly wasn't illegal. It wasn't against the rules. It doesn't necessarily make the Clippers look like the most honorable organization, but at the end of the day, I don't think they really think that they care, because DeAndre Jordan was such an integral part of that team, and really, without him, they're going to be barely contending for a playoff spot, let alone an NBA title. DeAndre Jordan changes kind of the makeup of the Western Conference, because I don't think DeAndre Jordan was going to make the Dallas Mavericks a championship contender. They were really another player away from being in that breadth of, you know, the San Antonio Spurs, the Oklahoma City Thunder, the Los Angeles Clippers, and the Golden State Warriors, and the Houston Rockets. The Mavericks were more than a player away of being in that company. But without DeAndre Jordan, the Clippers fall out of that company. So I think it was important in a lot of ways because it maintained that kind of top four or five team power structure in the Western Conference. It really would have been a redistribution of power if DeAndre Jordan had gone to the Mavericks. But, you know, after the dust kind of settled, you know, they had the whole thing with all the Clippers players tweeting out emojis, Chandler Parsons tweeted out the plane, and then Paul Pierce tweeted out a JPEG of an emoji of a rocket ship. I mean, it all was getting absolutely ridiculous. And at the end of the day, what we ended up hearing happened, and this is, of course, this was from the side of the Los Angeles Clippers. J.J. Redick appeared on the Low Post, Zach Lowe's podcast on the Grantland channel to talk about kind of how it all played out. And essentially what happened was DeAndre Jordan called Doc Rivers on Monday of last week and said, look, I think I made a mistake. I'd like to meet with you guys, kind of talk this over. But essentially by Wednesday when we were hearing that DeAndre Jordan was reconsidering his verbal agreement with Mavericks, he had all but decided to go back to the Los Angeles Clippers. And those guys getting there, essentially, as J.J. Redick explained it, all the guys meeting over at the house of DeAndre Jordan in Houston was really just a team-building session to talk about, okay, now DeAndre's back, how are we going to move forward, what are we going to do next season to continue to improve? Because the Clippers have added a lot of talent. I wouldn't say a lot, but they've added some more talent to help aid Chris Paul, DeAndre Jordan, and Blake Griffin in their chase for a title in adding Lance Stephenson and Paul Pierce, both of whom we know can be very important players to a playoff run. So just to get into kind of the was it right, does DeAndre Jordan owe the Dallas Mavericks organization an apology? Does he owe Chandler Parsons and Mark Cuban, the two that he led on, an apology? And to be quite honest, I would say no. I mean, I really think it was just the way the business works. I mean, was it immature of him to kind of back out at the last minute? Yes. Does it raise the question of what's to prevent free agents from doing this in the future? Like, say, LaMarcus Aldridge just wanted to gain a competitive edge over the Spurs. Well, the Spurs effectively ended their free agency hunt to add guys once LaMarcus Aldridge, they had verbally agreed with LaMarcus Aldridge. So what's to prevent team players from saying, oh, yeah, sure, I'll sign with you, and then the team kind of goes into coast mode for the rest of free agency and then flips at the last minute? Because essentially, Dallas Mavericks have no other options now in free agency except for maybe signing Deron Williams, who was waived. But again, to get back to what I was saying, I don't think that DeAndre Jordan owes the Dallas Mavericks organization an apology. He might owe casual fans an apology just because, Dallas fans were excited to have him come in there and play, but really he didn't owe that franchise anything. And if anything, the people that needed to be calling and telling Mark Cuban at that time that he was reconsidering his deal were his agents. I mean, that's what they, and the people that manage his career, because that's what they're there for. So I don't think that it was up to DeAndre Jordan to call Mark Cuban, to call Rick Carlisle, to call the guys in the front office of Mavericks and say, look, I'm rethinking my decision. It's up to his agent to do that. And there has been some reports that DeAndre Jordan and his family are not happy with how Dan Fagan, his agent, handled the whole situation. And Dan Fagan, of course, is also the agent of Dwight Howard. So we, of course, know how they've handled things in the past, especially with Dwight's decision between Los Angeles and Houston a few years ago, which played out not exactly the same way, but very similarly to Los Angeles didn't really know until the 11th hour that Dwight wasn't coming back to play for them. So it certainly made for a lot of entertaining news cycle for those 24 hours. And how the NBA has really just become, minus August, a year-round sport. I mean, it's like the NFL now. People are interested in the draft. People are interested in free agency. People are interested in the storylines building up to training camp. And people are paying attention and they're watching. And I think they have definitely shown that they merit that billion-dollar TV deal that's going to go into effect next season. Any final thoughts on kind of the whole DeAndre Jordan thing?
No, I just wanted to agree with you about the whole whether or not he owes an apology or anything, because maybe it's a little unprofessional to kind of keep the Mavericks in the dark, but I mean, it's not like you left him sitting literally at the table with the contract and just didn't show up.
Right.
They kind of had the impression that he was getting cold feet.
Right.
And it was just maybe a little uncourteous the way it seemed difficult, I guess, for the Mavericks to get an official word that he was having second thoughts. But it's nothing that warrants an actual apology of any official kind of account.
Yeah. So that's that. To talk a little bit more about how the power shakes out, it does kind of isolate that power, like I said, in those top five teams in the Western Conference. I mean, you forget about Oklahoma City, but they weren't a playoff team last year because they were missing Durant for most of the season and Russell Westbrook for large stretches. So they'll certainly be in contention. And they just matched Portland's offer of 4 years, $70 million to free agent Enes Kanter, which I don't want to get into because I'm still so frustrated by the dollar amount of that deal. But they'll be in contention for the Western Conference title. Golden State, of course, best team in the West, won an NBA title this year. Clippers have reloaded, and with DeAndre Jordan back, they'll be a threat to compete again. The Spurs are going to be fantastic. And the Rockets, I don't think, are done adding players in free agency. I don't think they're done making moves. And I would be interested to see if maybe they make a deal with the Nuggets to bring in a high-level point guard like Ty Lawson before this whole free agency period is over. Maybe a sign-and-trade deal is in the works there. So I think those top five teams, those are the five teams you can count on being in the picture of the Western Conference next year. And then the rest, I think, is kind of a dogfight for the finish. And I think when you look at it, the Mavericks probably fall out of that contention and they wouldn't have had they been able to sign DeAndre Jordan. So this was a big power move for a lot of these teams in the Western Conference. So we'll see how it all shakes out. So moving away from professional basketball, I want to talk about collegiate basketball a little bit. The Kansas Jayhawks completed their world tour.
Please, can we use their informal title for this?
Okay.
Team KUSA.
Team KUSA completed their world tour with a gold medal victory over Germany this morning in the World University Games in Korea. I got up to watch this game. It was awesome. I mean, at the end of the game, at the end of regulation, Frank Mason had a chance to win it for Team USA, and he turned the ball over. He came up short. It was a great drive. He got in the paint, but just lost the ball in the final seconds. Then in the first overtime, drives and penetrates the lane with about 4 seconds left, scores to force double overtime. And then, of course, KU goes on a 9-0 run to start off that double overtime set to win by 7 over Germany, 81-74. I was really excited when they came here in Kansas City to play Team Canada for 2 games, because I knew that Team Canada was a team that, you know, Team USA was going to be able to beat, Kansas was going to be able to handle easily. And I was just as excited going into the university games in Korea, because I knew it was going to be a great experience for the Jayhawks. We were going to kind of get a first look at this team 4 months ahead of schedule, because their first game isn't until November. We got to see Frank Mason emerge even more so as a leader, because he was the guy with the ball at the end of the game today, taking the big shots and coming up big in a lot of big moments. He was the leading scorer for this team on several occasions in the tournament. And then Seldon really emerged as a star for this squad during these World University Games. He led the team in scoring, played really physical defense, was up and down the floor, posterized a couple of players, let them know what Team USA and Kansas University is all about. And it gives this whole team, not just Seldon and Mason, a lot of meaningful playing time 4 months before the season starts. I mean, and it's especially valuable for players like LeGerald Vick and Carlton Bragg, who are freshmen next year, who are just finishing up their senior year of high school and are now in June and July playing, you know, world-class collegiate athletes. And so it's going to be really interesting to see how strong KU starts the season now, starting in November, because they've had so much experience playing together now. And you'll add Mikhailik in there, you know, Sfi will start playing again. Diallo will be playing come November. So there were some guys that were missing there, but in terms of the veterans on this team that got to play, I mean, this kind of experience, you can't really put a price on it. I think it's going to be great moving into next season. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I thought it's a good experience for them to get get it going, get some work in. But what a lot of people liked about the game today, especially, was the way it seemed like a lot of people were saying that they were showing more emotion for this game. More than, I know one of the big knocks on them from the last season was they seemed kind of emotionless. They were very talented, but there were times they would just go dry and it didn't seem like they were really into the game.
There wasn't a lot of heart behind
them. Yeah, exactly. And I know for this game, I was trying my best to follow it at work. They were trailing towards the end of regulation, mm-hmm. had to come back to go to overtime, trailing towards the end of the first overtime, had to come back, and then, what you said, they went 9-0 to start the second overtime?
Well, they were trailing to start. They actually got off to a slow start at the start of the second overtime, then went on a 9-0 run in overtime to supplement,
okay. But still,
supplement the Germans.
To take advantage like that, to take it to 2 overtimes and finally put their foot down and take advantage of it. They didn't give up, and they showed what they really could do.
Yeah.
I think it's a great experience for them.
Yeah, I think KU fans have every reason now to be excited about next season. Not that they didn't before, but I think this could be a really special team. I mean, with the veteran talent that we have on there and the young talent as well, it's got the makeup very similar of a 2008 team, 2011 championship team, or not championship, but, you know, national runner-up team. So we'll see. There's a lot of basketball left to be played, as in there's all the basketball left to be played. But we'll be geared up come November for the start of the season. So getting away from basketball, I want to jump into the Royals, who had another just fantastic week of baseball. At the end of the show last week, we talked about the importance of the seven remaining games for the Royals. Seven remaining home games. The Royals played a four-game set against the Rays and a three-game set against the Blue Jays. We said they needed to win a minimum of three games.
Well, they did a little better than that.
To carry the momentum in the All-Star break that we wanted to see, and they doubled that win total. And they went 6-1 and powered their way in the All-Star break after an offensive onslaught in their final game against the Blue Jays, where they even allowed 8 runs in one inning.
Oh, God, that was
painful. And still were able to win. I mean, if that's not the mark of a truly great team, then I don't know what is. They hold a 4.5-game lead over the Twins, a 9-game lead over the third-place Tigers, and, according to Baseball Prospectus, have a 68% chance to win the division this season. How great was it last week watching? I would say just 6 out of those 7 games were fantastic to watch. As a fan, how great was it for you last week just kind of witnessing the Royals playing, you know, knockdown, drag-out baseball?
Well, you know, it was really great because I really thought of last week as kind of a trap week. Neither team has a great record, but Tampa still in contention. They're for their division, still doing pretty well. And then Toronto is one of the most dangerous offenses in the major leagues, which they showed yesterday.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I think that was the ugliest game I've ever seen.
It was ugly, but all that matters is that we got the W.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's painful the way you started the game and you think you're going to cruise to win. Then you blow a 7-run lead in one inning. And I thought it was very poetic the way that game ended with Toronto players striking out. The guy on first tried to steal, and the throw was horrible, and the slide was even worse because he never even touched the bag until he was past it and reached back with his foot, and he was out by a full mile, I think.
Yeah. Well, so the Royals suffered one loss in the loss column last week, but they also suffered another major loss from a personnel standpoint. All-star left fielder, all-star starter left fielder, Alex Gordon, went down on Wednesday night in the game against the Rays with – at the start of him going down and then carting him off the field, looked like a pretty severe injury. Turned out to only be a severe groin strain, out up to 8 weeks. He's saying he wants to come back sooner. You know, the realistic prediction is that he comes back right at those 8 weeks. But why don't you walk me through kind of the whole, I guess, what goes through your mind when you see that happen? Because we were at trivia that night. And we were trying to get, it was the Tournament of Champions, they were trying to get trivia started. And I don't think anyone was really paying attention once everything played out the way that it did on Wednesday night.
So it was kind of scary because at first glance, you're thinking, oh, maybe he hurt himself because he ran in the wall pretty hard, and he does that a lot, and you figure it's going to catch up to him.
Right.
Then you see the replay, and it's even scarier because he started to fall, started to crumple before he even reached the wall, which usually will mean something more serious
right.
that happened.
Well, you know, watching it in real time, you know, you kind of got the general oohs, ahs from the general crowd in the bar. And then they showed the replay, and we couldn't tell if it was a knee, was it an ankle, and obviously those are, I mean, as bad if not worse than a groin strain. But, you know, the initial reaction was that he broke an ankle, that he tore a ligament in his knee, that there was my first initial reaction was I thought he tore his Achilles, because you see that kind of on those plays where you go from an even grass surface to the dirt surface, and that step right there is uneven, which I think is what caused that step to go wrong. Now, it's a groin strain. It's not an ideal injury. But it's certainly better than what the alternatives could have been, which we just listed.
Yeah, he could easily have been out for the season. Right. Had it been a knee injury or a broken ankle or something like
right.
that.
Or if the groin muscle had torn, or the muscle had torn away from the bone, which we saw that happen to Nomar Garciaparra about a decade ago, and he ended up missing 3 months of action to heal that groin tear. So I want to get in the conversation because we talked about making trades last week. We talked about the trade deadline, and we both agreed that the Royals are buyers going into this trade deadline, which is unusual because they typically weren't. We thought that they were going to be last season. They didn't make a move at the deadline, which actually worked out in their favor. So the question now is not, should they make a move? But what move is that? So I guess my first question to you is, do they need to make a move to strengthen our depth in the outfield? Or do we move forward with the guys we've got on the roster now with Dyson Orlando just, you know, filling in for him while he recovers from that injury?
So the way I see it, I think the Royals have enough pieces right now that they're willing to give up to trade for one player. They're not going to be able to get a pitcher and an outfielder. They got to go one or the other. And my initial reaction this morning was to stick with a starting pitcher. But then as I thought about it over the course of the day, I think they actually have a decent amount of depth at starting pitcher. As it turned by the end of the month, they should, because then they'll have originally starting, they'll have Medlin, they'll have Duffy's been pitching well. Ventura had a decent start when he came back. We'll have Volquez still. Young will still be there. I think
Vargas
will be back. I think Blanton's done
being
in the starting rotation. So we'll have about seven guys potentially. And by the time you get down to the end of the season and into the playoffs, assuming we make it, you only need four starters.
Right.
So I think we're better off keeping them the way that is and then trying to make a play for an outfielder. Because I do think we could do okay with an Orlando and a Dyson kind of platoon type thing. The problem is, Alex Rios is playing subpar defense right now, and he's not hitting real well either, so he's not really giving us a reason to keep him around.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, there are two names that kind of got tossed around this morning when I was, you know, kind of doing some research into guys who are going to likely be available. The biggest guy, you know, standing out for me right now is Jay Bruce for the Cincinnati Reds, because the Reds are obviously going to be sellers at the trade deadline because they're not having the season that they had anticipated. Jay Bruce not having a Jay Bruce-like year. He's hitting .251, but he has 13 home runs and 42 RBIs. He's actually hitting, you know, for average, what his average is for his career. He's about a .250 career average hitter. I think he's a great option to cover for Gordon in left field until he gets back. And then he's also a great option to supplant Rios when Gordon comes back healthy, because I don't think Alex Rios is a realistic solution for this ball club in right field. He looked that way at the start of the year, but it's starting to prove more and more he's not that player he was in Toronto. He was the player that we saw in Texas and Chicago. And like you said, he's not really helping us defensively or offensively, so really what good is he doing out there? You could make an argument that when Gordon comes back, you could move Orlando to start and right if it really became that dire, or you could just start, you know, rotate Dyson and Rios and Orlando in there. But I think you need some consistency in terms of who your starters are. And I think Jay Bruce would be an option there where you can plug him in. And he's under contract for he's not just under contract to the end of the season. He's got subsequent years left on his contract. So it wouldn't just be a one-year rental. You'd have time to get this guy in and have him be an everyday starter out in right field. The other guy I've heard thrown around is Gerardo Parra from Milwaukee. Having a pretty solid year for the Brewers, but the issue with him is that his contract is up after this year, so we would likely just have him as a rental. So those are the two big names that I've heard so far today in terms of Royals' possible solutions out in the outfield. What are your thoughts on those two options as it stands kind of right now?
It's an interesting choice, basically choosing between a rental player and a guy you can keep around for a couple years. I would say I'd probably go with the rental player, because I think we can get him cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's potential for someone maybe to come up through our system,
through
the farm system, who can we can have as a cheaper option out there.
So you'd rather us go after somebody like Parra?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I can see your argument there, but, you know, Bruce has been a solid, you know, solid veteran on that role, on that Reds club. And, you know, I just think, when you're trying to win, like I said, I've alluded to it in past weeks, the window's closing pretty rapidly for this ball club, whether we want to admit it or not. And his contract is not huge. It's manageable. He signed through 16 on the current deal that he's on, and then he's got a year option or a team option for 2017. So when it comes down to whether or not we've got a guy in the farm system we can bring up to replace him eventually, or, you know, Rios comes back on or whatever, or there's a logjam within our depth in that position, I think Jay Bruce makes the most sense. I don't know how, you know, hard the Royals are pursuing him, but I'd rather have him and know that we have a veteran who's a proven veteran in that spot for years to come, rather than play the position as a gamble for next year's offseason or a rookie that comes up through the system. I think when you're trying to make a World Series run, you want a guy who is invested in the future success of this team, not just the present success. And so I think having a guy on loan, you know, essentially what we talked to, you don't want to mortgage your future for a guy who's not going to be around. We had that discussion about Cueto last week. I don't want to mortgage my future for a guy like Gerardo Parra, who's probably going to sign a contract, you know, after his deal is up this year. I want a guy who's going to be committed to this organization for a couple years to come. And we would have him at least through 16. And then if next year doesn't work out, we can either make a trade with him at the deadline. We can move him in the offseason. And then we don't have to pick up that 2017 team option. So there's a lot – I think there's a lot of ways to navigate around locking into him long term. I think that him having another year on that deal doesn't necessarily mean we're obligated to keep him around for that extra year. But I think he gives us the best solution in terms of a veteran presence on the ball club to make that push for a World Series title. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely understand that argument. I still think it'd be better because I don't know. I feel like since his contract's longer, we're going to have to give up more to get him. And I still think we could either sign someone in free agency or develop someone to fill that role, because I feel we don't want to add more payroll than we need to, because we're already trying to free up money to sign our bigger stars on our team. There's still hope to bring Eric Hosmer back, although I feel most people assume he will be gone when his contract is up next season, or he may be traded next season. We're trying to get Gordon back, although his injury may up the chance that he takes his player option rather than seeking free agency, mm-hmm. where he'd sign a bigger contract. So there is a little hope there, but I think it would just be, considering we have a usable solution with switching Orlando and Dyson out there, so I think we should just go with the rental player.
Okay, fair enough. Well, let's move away from the Royals, and we'll talk about the All-Star game. We're going to have Brody come in today and talk about what makes Cincinnati such a great location for the All-Star game. Brody's not around, so we can go ahead and just declare Cincinnati is not a great location for the All-Star game. Brody's got some Cincinnati ties. His family's from there, but it's in Ohio, so how great can it really be?
Okay.
We're going to go ahead and do our picks for the Home Run Derby, which is tonight, starting in about 15 minutes. We're going to try and get these recorded before the Home Run Derby starts. The first round, essentially what happens is it's seeds pitted against each other, the way it works differently this year. So the first round we'll see Albert Pujols against Chris Bryant, who's number 8 seed, and then Todd Frazier versus Prince Fielder, Frazier being the number 2 and Fielder being the number 7. Then Josh Donaldson versus Anthony Rizzo, Josh Donaldson number 3, Rizzo the number 6, and then Jock Peterson of the Dodgers against Manny Machado of the Baltimore Orioles. Now, I don't want to get into who's going to beat who, da-da-da-da-da. I just want your pick for who is going to win the Home Run Derby title. Give me why, and then we will see if we agree. So go ahead and give me your pick for the Home Run Derby tonight in Cincinnati. It's to you. Go.
I'm going to go with Prince Fielder.
Okay, and why Prince Fielder?
So I think the edge on this one is going to go to the older players, because with the new time limit thing, I think it's going to help that these players have been in this before. They know how the Derby works. They know how to take pitches and when to hit. And so I think it'll definitely help them out. Although the time limit has actually shrunk today. They moved it from 5 down to 4 because of the threat of rain.
Right.
So, because I was also thinking about picking one of the younger players because I think they'll have more stamina.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm taking a little bit of a risk with Prince Fielder because I know during one round. He's a big boy. He's the kind of guy who would stop in the middle of a round and go chug a Gatorade and then come back. He'd have 15-minute rounds. But I'll stick with him. He's a 2-time winner.
Okay. And I will go ahead and say I think the reason you listed last is the reason why Prince Fielder won't win it this year. I definitely agree he's got the most experience in a competition like this. The guy with the experience besides him is an Albert Pujols, but it's been a couple of years since he last performed in a Home Run Derby. So I think not just the format, but just getting back into that mode of playing in a Home Run Derby will affect him. My pick is going to go ahead and be Jock Peterson, the rookie center fielder out of Los Angeles, for two reasons. One, I think his youth and just his stamina will be a big reason why he's able to play really well in those timed rounds. And two, we've had Dodgers rookies play in this competition in the past decade. Last year, Yasiel Puig failed to hit a single home run in his competition last year, and the last was Matt Kemp before him, who didn't perform particularly well either. So history lined up against Jock Peterson here. To perform well in this Home Run Derby. But I think he's going to come out and perform. He's one of the league leaders in home run distance this year, which is going to, I think, help him greatly in this competition. And like I said, his youth is really going to play a big factor. He's the only rookie competing in the competition. He is the only rookie starting for the National League. Oh, excuse me, I take that back. No, I don't. He is the only rookie starting for the National League. I was confused that maybe Chris Bryant was going to be starting at third base, but Frazier for Cincinnati will be starting at third base. So yeah, I think his youth, combination of his youth and the battle against history is going to lead Jock Peterson to the Home Run Derby title. But we got to watch it to find out.
Yeah.
So, and that's starting in 10 minutes. So we got to wrap this show up pretty quickly so we can sit down and watch the show. So we'll move into our last two categories of the night. First one, Justin Houston contract situation. It was announced today that the Kansas City Chiefs and Justin Houston will renew talks tomorrow on a new contract, just one day ahead of the Wednesday deadline, which means they will not be able to negotiate a new deal during the season once they hit Wednesday. He has not signed his $13 million franchise tender. And there's reports saying that Justin Houston is looking for money close to that of what J.J. Watt received in his recent deal with the Houston Texans, which was for 6 years, $100 million. So Houston's seeking roughly $16 million per year. We've discussed before that we believe Houston deserves to be paid, but we don't want the Houston contract to be a reason that we can't afford to sign other integral players on the roster down the road. Why don't you talk? Give me a little bit of your thoughts on the situation and from the Justin Houston camp, how they should proceed, and from the Kansas City Chiefs perspective, how they should proceed, and how you'd like this whole thing to play out.
So I think from Justin Houston's camp, they're doing everything according to plan. He's proven himself to be a great player and definitely worth the money he wants, I think. He's a young star, came close to breaking the NFL record for sacks in a season. Now, I do see a little bit of a drop-off next season. I believe J.J. Watt's the only player in NFL history now to record back-to-back 20-sack seasons.
Right.
So it's not statistically in Houston's favor that he'll do it again next season. But that's, 14 sacks is great
yeah.
for a season. So that's an eight sack drop off for him, and he'd still have a great season.
Yeah.
From the Chiefs' standpoint, it's a little more difficult because they need to pay him, but they have a lot of big contracts right now.
Right. We have the least amount of cap space. I mean, we have about $800,000 in cap space, so we got to come up with that money somewhere. So it can be a challenge for them.
Yeah, because that's always the game in the NFL is cap space. You don't have to worry about who's the richest team and who's that. It's how you can work the contracts
right.
to make it work. And so we're running into a problem right now because we're still on the hook for Eric Berry, who possibly may not be ready for this season,
mm-hmm.
although we're always hearing – we haven't heard anything bad yet about him. So all signs point to him making a good recovery
yeah.
and hopefully being back maybe this season or next season.
Absolutely.
Alex Smith has a decent-sized contract.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be time to pay Travis Kelce at some point. Jamal Charles is a large deal. Jeremy Maclin just signed a large deal. I kind of talked about this when we've discussed in other conversations. But much like the Royals, the Chiefs have a pretty narrow window in which they can make a big splash before a lot of their younger talent is due a big payday and before a lot of their older talent is past their prime. For some players like Justin Houston, that payday has already arrived, and he's asking for that money now. So I think it's the challenge to become determining how valuable he is to this franchise and how hit that contract would, how much it will affect our ability to sign our talent down the road, because it almost certainly is going to affect this team down the road in terms of the quality of players they're able to bring in and negotiate with. I just want both sides to make the decision that's best for them, and I want that decision to be, Justin Houston, re-signing with the Kansas City Chiefs and us getting this mess out of the way so we can just worry about playing football come the fall.
Yeah, I agree. I think he needs to be on our team.
Yeah. So that does it for the sports talk of the week. Going to go ahead and get into pop culture, which now simply consists of our True Detective breakdown each week. Episode 4 of True Detective came out last night. Down Will Come was the name of the episode. And we finally have a suspect in the murder of Ben Casper, Ledo Amarilla. Or I guess he's the only suspect that's really being pursued at this point. My thought is that Ledo Amarilla is likely not the masked birdman who tortured and killed Ben Casper. But we do know he took a lot of Ben Casper's stuff because Ben Casper was seeing one of the prostitutes that is... serves within Leto Amarilla's ring. But I think we maybe saw the start of something much larger. There's obviously somebody working against a lot of the moving parts, a lot of the main characters in this show. So we see Frank Semien starting to kind of sink deeper and deeper into the pits of crime he had kind of previously crawled out of. He's shaking down former associates and starting to run drugs through the old bar, the club that he used to own. He's really doing anything it takes to survive right now, including possibly alienating his beautiful wife, who is trying to do her best to support him, but it's clear that Frank Semien is losing his mind.
Yeah, it's kind of bad to see him regress like this. He's kind of going back about three steps, going back to, he rebought a club, he's shaking down all his old associates, people who have said they paid him off, and he's asking for more money from him. It's never a good look.
No.
But I would like to see him hopefully succeed in this so he can get back to where he was.
Right. And I think, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that this show is probably not going to end well for Frank Semien. I mean, it's likely not going to end well for most of the characters in the show, because it's in a little bit more of a bleak, grim stage right now at this point in the show than it was last year. I see less redeeming qualities in these four main characters than I did in Marty and Rust from last year. But each week I find myself, I'll just stick with the Frank Semien character a little bit, I find myself annoyed with another part of Vaughn's character. But it's not necessarily Vaughn's performance that's at fault. I think it's the writing. It just doesn't seem to, one, it just doesn't seem to fit the style of, you know, Vaughn's acting. And two, I don't think it really fits the general motif of the show and kind of who Frank Semien is. I think Nick Pizzolatto has tried to write a lot of scenes where Frank gets deep and philosophical, but he only kind of grazes the surface of what he's trying to get down to. And I think it just makes, it's almost like pandering to what the audience expects from, you know, last year when we had McConaughey kind of go on those philosophical rants about our existence and human, and, you know, human consciousness being a mistake or all these things. I feel like they're trying to graze the surface of that with Frank Semien. And really the character who's best equipped for that is Ray's character. But Ray, we kind of only see as this surface figure who's dealing with all these internal struggles, but we don't really hear a lot of what's going on inside his head. And we don't hear that verbalized in the same way that we hear Frank talking about it. You know, last week he talks about the fact that he can't take a shit without someone feeling like someone's behind him saying, make sure it's a good one. You know, I think I'd like to see a lot of that internalization externalized, but not from Frank anymore. I want to see that internal struggle externalized by Ray, by Annie, by Paul. We've started to see both Annie and Paul kind of start to lose their way a little bit in this most recent episode as well. So moving on to those other characters, Annie is now facing sexual misconduct case. She's under review by her department for her past relationships with her subordinates. Paul is dealing with the ramifications of a drunken night where he clearly slept with one of his former war buddies or lover, and his motorbike was stolen, which we know is his prized possession. And then Ray meets with Frank, and Frank offers him an out of his police work and offers for him to come work for Frank entirely, leave behind being a cop, leaving behind, you know, the mess of the state investigation. And Frank said something interesting, I think, which maybe probably made everyone kind of do some sort of level of self-examination last night, is when he says to Ray, your best self may be your worst self. And I think Ray thought pretty strongly about that. And I think to some degree, Ray believes that he's right. What were your thoughts on that scene between Ray and Frank in the bar?
It was pretty interesting. I mean, it's pretty deep thought,
right,
to think that maybe your best self is, or your worst self is your best self.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that definitely fits for Ray Belcoro.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've seen that he's most effective when he's drunk, kind of.
Mm-hmm. And angry.
I think his anger is really what drives him.
Yeah.
And so that was my impression of the scene.
Yeah, and so then we start to see kind of the episode beginning to unravel. The layers are starting to pull away a little bit. Ray Velcoro gives his father's badge, which his father threw in the trash last week, to his son, maybe his real son or not. And we presume that Ray knows to some degree that this is the last time he'll see his son for quite a while, with the whole custody battle and everything that's going on. That was a powerful scene, I thought. I think it shows again, those scenes are important to showing the humanity of Ray Velcoro a little bit. He does have something to live in, to fight for how much longer, we're not quite sure. But the episode culminates in the three officers, Ray, Ani, and Paul, preparing to raid the building where Leo Amaria is presumed to be located and running his operation out of. Some wonder if this was bad police work, you know, taking approximately 10 officers on a raid. You probably could have called in SWAT units or called in more backup. But nonetheless, they've taken about 10 police officers in for this raid, and all-out shootout begins. And this isn't the first time we've seen a shootout in the fourth episode of True Detective. Of course, last year we had Russ taking some members of the whatever organization he was with out to the house to do a drug deal, and there was a shootout in that scene. So it almost felt like we were seeing a similar scene play out over again, but there's a lot more carnage in this scene. They're massive casualties. Many of them were civilian casualties. What were your thoughts while watching this all play out last night?
Well, just as it was leading into that scene, I think they were really trying to hint that there were going to be some big casualties. Just the way they were playing, they kept talking about the numbers. And you know how you watch, like, basically any cop show, and there's some kind of raid, you know, police raid? You always get the impression there's basically unlimited police forces.
Right.
You know, you may see the main character go chasing after someone, but there's always still a police presence. You always feel like there's tons of cops blocks away just ready to move in. And in this instance, they made a very big, they were very clear to show you that there were only about 10 cops.
Right.
They had, I mean, there was about a full minute you had a chance that you could count each one, and you knew kind of that they weren't, there weren't enough.
Mm-hmm.
And even at the start of that, the shootout, I think they maybe two or three got taken out right away.
Right.
And then even towards the end of the shootout, when it was just, you know, the three main characters left there, you still thought there was a chance that the bad guys could get away because
right.
it was 2-on-3.
Yeah, and they had automatic weapons.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, the rest of the police, you know, Ray, Annie, and Paul were essentially using, they were just using handguns. And at one point, Annie runs out of bullets. And we see her kind of turn to the self-defense mode where all that's left between her and the criminal is that knife we've heard talking about.
Yeah.
You know, when there's all that's left between you and a man who you can't defend yourself physically from is that knife that makes her feel a lot more safe. Well, she didn't look like she felt safe in that scene. So I think we're starting to see a little bit more of, you know, her insecurities kind of played out, and they definitely played out during that scene. Both her and Ray, I just kind of wanted to note this, were both visibly shaken up by what they just saw.
Yeah.
One character wasn't. Paul was not fazed at all by what he had just seen. In fact, he seemed calmer than he had seemed in the entire episode at the end of that carnage. People thought, well, maybe this was a trigger, some sort of PTSD. It did not. He looked like it was fine. In fact, he looked comfortable in that environment. Did you kind of notice a similar thing?
I actually didn't notice that, but that does kind of make sense, though, that those two, that Ani and Ray would be shaken up, and him and Paul, having served in the Middle East, and we kind of know, we don't know what happened over there other than it appears he had a relationship with another soldier,
yeah.
But he's, I think he's seen some stuff, so right. He seemed like he was used to something like
that. There's rumors, I think they alluded to a little bit on the show, that his unit was being charged with killing of 12 unarmed civilians in a raid in Iraq. So it wouldn't surprise me if Paul is kind of numb to the idea of civilian casualties. And it seemed to be that way at the conclusion of last night's episode. So I think we've started to get a peek into the crime conspiracy of the show. I don't think it's clear who the true detective is. I know they kind of talked about who the true detective was last year, whether it was Marty, whether it was Rust. But I think we started to get a peek into the conspiracy that's surrounding these four characters and that are caught in the middle. But I think, like most episodes of True Detective, I'm left with a lot of questions. What were your thoughts after this episode?
So I had one final thought on the shootout. I thought it was interesting. They made a point to show that Frank and his wife were in that crowd where there were protesters and news reporters. And at the beginning of the scene, when the building explodes, the top level of the building explodes, Frank tells his wife to go inside. But I noticed for the rest of that shootout, they don't show them at all. So it could be nothing.
Right.
Maybe nothing happened. But I also wouldn't be surprised to see if maybe one of them, I don't think they'd be dead, but maybe caught a bullet or something. They may be hiding something that they want to reveal in this next episode.
Yeah. So that's still left to be seen. For me, I just want to, you know, say the jury is still out on whether this season has been good or not, because I just don't know. Because a lot of times I don't know what I'm watching, because I think this is one of these shows where you have to determine at the end how everything played out. Much like when we watched Bloodlines. The quality of whether or not the show was good, whether it was all... I'm not saying whether it was good, because I think it's been good. Is it all worth it? Is what we're watching going to be worth it in the end? And I think to some degree, you know, last year the 7 episodes leading up to the finale of True Detective were really good. The last one kind of left you with a little bit of a bittersweet taste in your mouth because it was over and there was the ending, the re-ending between Marty and Russ. But the killer kind of ended up being, it wasn't this big cult, it wasn't this mystic, you know, thing that was, you know, with the Yellow King. It was just kind of this, you know,
crazy
half-wit who was killing people. So I'd like to see this, these last four episodes really expand on what's been happening thus far, maybe go a little bit deeper as Frank takes the plunge into the dark crime world of Vinci and as these other characters start to explore their own humanity a little bit more. And their mortality, because I think that's something that Annie kind of had to come to face with during that shootout. So, like I said, jury's still out on this season, but I'm excited for next Sunday. I'm excited for more True Detective, as always. So that concludes this episode of the Built on the Border podcast. We thank you guys again for joining. If you're listening, we really appreciate it. Again, you can interact with us on Twitter or on or via email. You can reach us at BorderKC on Twitter or at builtontheborder@gmail.com. That is our email address. We'd love to hear from you on your thoughts on what we can do better on the show, maybe some segments that we can include. And this will probably be the last episode done from the 4621 Wyoming Street address. The next ones will probably be done at different locations in Kansas City. So this has been a good location, a good studio that we've been doing these shows in so far, but we might be moving the Built on the Border to the other side of the border, onto the Kansas side. What do you think of that, Tom?
Well, in terms of this being a good studio, I appreciate the room. Let's be honest. This is a bad studio.
Right.
We're in dining room.
Yeah, we're in a dining room. The acoustics aren't great, but the Built on the Border podcast will be moving on to bigger and better things, and that might be moving into Kansas. So
yeah, we'll see if our opinions somehow change.
Yeah.
Kansas.
So in honor of the Kansas City Royals having 7 All-Stars in this year's game, we will be playing you guys out with none other than Smash Mouth's smash hit All-Star. For Mr. Tommy Watson, this is Tommy Randolph. Have a great week. Try and stay cool out there and enjoy the All-Star game. Peace. To the rules and I hit the ground running. Didn't make sense not to live for fun. Your brain gets smart but your head gets dumb. So much to do, so much to see. So what's wrong with taking the back streets? You'll never know if you don't go. You'll never shine if you don't glow. Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on, get paid. And they say it gets colder. You're bundled up now, wait till you get older. But the media men beg to differ, judging by the hole in the satellite picture. The ice we skate is getting pretty thin. The water's getting warm, so you might as well swim. My world's on fire, how about yours? That's the way I like it and I'll never get bored. Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on, get paid. Show on, get